This podcast is brought to you by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Lectures, radio shows, and more on demand at sevillepodcast.com. Fiction favorites Homer Hickam, Adriana Trigiani, and Jill A. Davis delighted a full house at the University of Virginia's Culber Theater on Thursday night, March 27, 2008, as part of the 14th Annual Virginia Festival of the Book. Moderator Robert Vaughn of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities joined them for a lively and hilarious discussion of the writing life.
But I'm delighted to see all of you. I'm Rob Vaughn with the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. And I have personally enjoyed this book festival as much as any that I have attended, and I've been to all 14 of them. It's been a treat, and I'm looking forward to the treat that we're going to have this evening with these three writers.
I don't know.
This is a fiction evening. It reminds me that I have spent 30 years arguing with my historian friends about the relative values of fiction and nonfiction. I contend that we can learn a whole lot more about place, about character, about history, about time from fiction than we can from history, and naturally the historians dispute that profoundly, but they're wrong. If you want to know about the coal fields of West Virginia or Virginia, you might read one of these writers instead of a historian about the coal fields. They're going to speak in the order in which I'm going to introduce them. We'll keep it brief because you came to hear them and not to hear about them, I think. Homer Hickam's going to go first. He was from Coalwood, West Virginia, and graduated from Big Creek High School. And from there, he went to our in-state rival across the mountains here, Virginia Tech. Hey! Into the Army. Worked for as an engineer with the U.S. Army Missile Command and then with the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Became a scuba diver. And along the way, he decided that he'd really like to write. And, of course, he became extraordinarily well-known with the publication of Rocket Boys, especially when it was turned into a film which called October Sky, which is based on that book, which was based on his life and growing up in West Virginia. His newest book, the novel Red Helmet, was published in this year, so it's fresh off the press. I thought it was interesting that Homer also got selected to carry the Olympic torch when it went through Huntsville, Alabama, some years back. And now he's an amateur paleontologist.
I know.
Jill Davis grew up in Reading, Pennsylvania, another almost coal field area. This is one of two things that we've discovered that these people have in common. And I'm going to let somebody else tell you the other one, the one degree of separation from somebody that we'll hear about. She started life, her writing life anyway, working for Letterman, and did a number of television pilots. She was nominated for 5 Emmy Awards, became involved in writing short stories and screenplays, and she's currently working on her 3rd novel. The first two, Girls Poker Night and Ask Again Later. She's known in the critical community for having an acerbic wit, a quirky outlook, for being humorous, meaning absolutely laugh out loud funny. She's also known for being heartfelt and poignant and for the depth of character that she creates. I thought it was interesting that Joan Didion, who certainly is a different kind of writer, described her as blithe and engaging and off the wall funny. So we're in for a treat there as well. Adriana Trigiani grew up in Big Stone Gap, so she's a Virginian.
Really?
I don't think.
Pound? Grab out of football. Sorry, I digress. Go ahead. You want to hear all these wonderful things.
I did hear a story about the Mountain Empire Community College bus that they created some years ago to take kids, community college students to college, and they actually could study on the bus. And there were stories about there's a town down there spelled D-A-N-T-E, Dante pronounced Daint. But The people over in Clinch Valley were
very well.
Yeah, the people over in Clinch Valley talked about the course on the Mountain Empire bus, world literature from Dante to Pound. There was another one about on the road with St. Paul to Damascus. Two other towns down there. But we digress too much here.
Brilliant. I never heard that.
You never did?
No.
I'm glad to be able to tell you something about the community you're from. Grew up with a big Italian family, in case you didn't recognize it from the name, and has written a number of books about Big Stone Gap. That was the first, followed by Big Cherry Holla and Milk Glass Moon. She's been writing lately Lucia, The Queen of the Big Time, Rococo. And I found it really interesting that she and her sisters, one of the co-authors, sister was Mary, have published Cooking with My Sisters. It's a memoir and a cookbook, all blended in together. Recipes, stories dating back 100 years or more about her Italian family, Italian heritage in Big Stone Gap. Lucia was selected in 2004 as the best read in England. Found that interesting. Was eighth in Britain on the 2004 Associated Press list of the world's bestseller books.
Awesome.
She left Big Stone. She left Big Stone Gap for New York City via college in South Bend, Indiana, at St. Mary's, the companion school to Notre Dame. I'm really pleased that all three of them are here. I was already entertained and enlivened by being with them in the green room, and I look forward to this. We will, each of them will talk and read a little, and then we will open the floor for questions and have a little conversation afterwards. So think about questions while we're getting ready here. Homer?
All right.
All right. Thank you, Rob. Well, first thing I like to do, since the memoir Rocket Boys was mentioned, and obviously the movie October Sky, is to apologize to all the young ladies in the audience for not actually being Jake Gyllenhaal. I know there's some of you out there staring at me going, where is that boy, and who is this? Who's this old gray-haired dude that's talking to me here? But so, all right, got that out of the way. The other thing that Rob was mentioning that, I mean, we have had a ball back in the green room already. We left probably most of our best material back there. I'm sorry that weren't plugged in with that. But we actually have in common David Letterman. Jill wrote for David Letterman, and I say she won the Emmy. She just forgot to show up that night. They handed them out. Adriana, her husband, worked as the lighting director for David Letterman. Me, I taught David Letterman to scuba dive. But Linda says I can't tell that story, so I have to talk about my work. I do want to talk about my name. Adriana backstage said in agreement, said, I just love that name, Homer. And I said, well, are you going to name any children after me? And she said no. But my full name, if you look on my latest books, it says Homer Hickam. That's all it says, Homer Hickam. The first book I ever wrote was a book called Torpedo Junction, which was a nonfiction history of the U-boat wars up and down the East Coast. Don't ask. It's still in print, by the way. I had the whole name, Homer H. Hickam Jr., and the same thing for Rocket Boys. And actually, the whole name is Homer Hadley Hickam Jr. Now, folks, I'm the second son, okay? And we know that the tradition in this country is, as it should be, that the first son gets the father's name. My brother's name is Jim. Jim Hickam. And if your name is Jim Hickam, you are naturally going to get all the girls and you're going to be a big football star. But if you're growing up in the little town of Colwood, West Virginia, and your name is Homer Hadley Hickam Jr., there's a problem. And I complained about that to my folks. And now, since we're talking about fiction here, My mom told me this story. I take it as true. She said, I want to tell you how you got your name. You see, when you were born back in 1943, you know, for you kids in their timeline, dinosaurs died out, World War II, 1943. They built a new hospital. Actually, they built the only hospital in McDowell County, Stevens Clinic, and I decided that unlike every child that had ever been born in Colwood, West Virginia, you were going to be born in a hospital because you were going to be a girl. And everybody decided that I was going to be a girl. And so Mom had gone through all the possible names and had decided to call me Susie. And so she told my dad, who was a foreman at the mine, she said, Homer, little Susie's going to be born over in Stevens Clinic. And Dad had just been promoted, and he said, Elsie, don't be putting on airs now. You're going to have Susie right there, you know, in the bedroom, just like every, you know, where it all starts. You know, it's kind of a, you know, full circle. That's the way we do it here in Colwood. And my mom said, well, you know, we'll see about that. So then the night came, February 19th, 1943, and when little Susie decided to show up, and there was a huge blizzard, one of the biggest blizzards ever known in all of human history in McDowell County. And my dad thought that was so funny, you know, Mom going in her labor pains. Well, I guess you're not going over to Stevens Clinic now, are you? My mom did nothing but hike up her skirts and go through the snow next door to the Roses, lived next door to Rhody, and said, Rhody, get your Studebaker going. We're going across the mountain to Welch and the Stevens Clinic, and little Susie's going to be born over in the hospital like she's supposed to. So they did. Off they go, slipping and sliding with my dad on the porch going, well, you'll never make it. But they did, and so 11:30 that night, little Susie was born with something extra, and so everybody wanted to come over and see the new baby boy, as it turned out, and of course, the mom hadn't thought about a name. She had Susie all picked out, and she was really disappointed, but everybody from Colwood came over except my dad. He was making a real point of not coming over, and back then, hospitals were so new, you could hang out there pretty much as long as you wanted to. You know, and I think that's the real reason Mom wanted to go to Stevens Clinic, because, you know, she stayed for 2 weeks. So Dad's boss, Captain Laird, came over, and Mom said, Captain, you go back there and tell Homer, if he doesn't get over here to see his baby boy, I'm going to take him, and we're headed to Myrtle Beach. And she wasn't kidding. So Dad all came. He came to the hospital and walked in the room, and Mom was holding me. And he took one look and said, "Elsie, that's the ugliest baby I've ever seen in my life." And turned around and walked out. And the next person in the room was a nurse with the clipboard, and she said, "Well, Mrs. Hickam, have you decided what you're going to name this baby boy?" Yeah, he said, "I'm going to name this one after his father." So, that's how I got to be Homer Hadley Hickam Jr., which I have shortened now to Homer. Actually, I was raised as Sonny, which was my mom said, "I'm going to call him Sonny because he's the light of my life." And Dad said, "Well, Elsie, you're following a mighty dim beacon as far as I can." But anyway, that was, life in Colwood was fun. And thank goodness I grew up in a place like Colwood. It was one of these pure company towns, you know, and I had real interesting parents. I'm sure glad they were interesting, because I ended up writing, you know, in effect, 4 books about them. Colwood was just this place where everything was owned by the company, every fence, every road, every house, every store. Even the church was owned by the company, and the preacher was a company man. We used to laugh and say we got the low bid religion, you know, whatever. whatever it was. So ultimately, after I wrote Torpedo Junction, just real quick on how I came to write Rocket Boys was, I got real busy with my NASA career after TJ, and I actually wrote a real short story about building rockets when I was a kid in Colwood, and next thing I knew, I had publishers calling me, New York publishers, saying, are you going to write a book about that? And I said, well, I guess I am now. And so that's how I ended up writing Rocket Boys, and that's my second book, and I know it's a book that I'll be known forever for. They made that movie, and then also it's still the most picked community and library read in the country. It's on almost every school reading list, and so, you know, we're real proud, and they're also writing a Broadway play based on Rocket Boys. So it's my classic. And, you know, Harper Lee basically said, if you write a classic, Homer, you should quit. People will resent you if you write any more. They don't want you to write any more after that. And, you know, she pointed out that Margaret Mitchell was a kid. Well, and I said, well, yeah, but she was run over by a taxi cab, so I'm not sure that counts. But anyway, so, I'm from West Virginia. I'm hard-headed. I'm going to keep writing. And the next books after Rocket Boys was the follow-on books to Rocket Boys, the Colwood Way, and then Sky of Stone, and then We Are Not Afraid. Actually, Back to the Moon, a techno thriller that I had written before I'd written Rocket Boys, and because it was the number one New York Times bestseller, they said, what else you got? And I said, oh, I can write one real quick. And I just reached down in the bottom of the desk and brought it up and handed it to them, and they actually published it. And it's a pretty good book. It's dedicated to my wife, Linda. And the women and men of NASA. But anyway, so after that, but after the series of memoirs, I decided that I really, 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 really wanted to write fiction. And that began I asked Random House, who did the Rocket Boy stuff, I said, I'm tired of these memoirs. I call them novoirs, by the way. They're novel memoirs. They're written like novels. And when I go into bookstores, they're over in American history. I say, why don't you just take them out in the street and burn them? You can't find them there. So I decided I wanted to get with Jill and Adriana and be in the well-lit part of the bookstore. So I told Random House, I want to write some fiction. And they said, we love your memoirs. So I went over to St. Martin's and said, I want to write fiction. And they said, okay, buddy, go for it. So I wrote three books, the Josh Thurlow series. If you haven't read them, trust me, you'll like them. They've got beginnings, middles, and ends, which I focus on that. And you'll like them. They're full of adventure, and they got really strong characters. Josh Thurlow is a very strong Coast Guard officer during World War II, and there's always a strong-willed female up against him. I'm into to writing about strong-willed female. I grew up in a town that was just filled with them, and now I'm on the stage with a couple of them. So, you know, I don't have a whole lot of choice. But anyway, so that was the Josh Thurlow series, and I actually was signed to write another one of those, or some. I almost forget now what I was signed to write. But anyway, I was signed to write something else when the Sago mine disaster happened. And anytime there's a mine disaster or a space disaster, I'm on everybody's Rolodex. So I got called, and I knew that this one was going to be different from the one in Pennsylvania where everybody got out. I knew right away that they weren't. And so I started talking about coal miners and what kind of people they really are and what their families are really like. And I said, you know, they're proud of who they are. And it just surprised people. I said, yes, they're proud of who they are. They love being miners. They stand up for what they believe. And they keep their families together. It's almost an alien concept in this country anymore. They just believe in the family. They do anything to keep it together. And they trust in God, but they rely on themselves. And I guess the Sago family is like that because they asked me to come up and give the remarks at the Sago Memorial, which I was just honored to do. And when I did it, I met the families and I met modern day coal miners. And I'd been writing about, you know, in the memoirs, miners of 50 years ago. And I went back and I told the publisher, I don't want to write that book that I'd signed for. What I really, really, really want to write is a book about set in coal mining Appalachia today. And they said, that sounds like a good idea, Homer. So you do that. And then I thought, how am I going to do that? And what I decided to do was to make it into a love story. I mean, For one thing, I thought, I'll be pioneering a new genre, coal mining chick lit. And that'll be cool. And I'm not sure I can actually do that. But I try to do new things. So Red Helmet is a quick thumbnail sketch. It's about this beautiful, rich, very talented New York City woman, sort of like Jill and Adriana, kind of, you know. And so this New York City woman who always has been unlucky in love and continues to be unlucky when she falls in love with a West Virginia guy. And he's a West Virginia coal mine manager, and the red helmet comes from that's what novice coal miners wear. So I don't think it gives away too much because it's on the cover. that the woman ultimately has to put on the red helmet or the red hat, as they call it in West Virginia, and go down and learn how to mine some coal. So I've gotten some really great reaction from folks who say, you know, it's the first time I ever read a book about coal mining Homer, but it was interesting. It was a page turner, and so I hope you enjoy this love story, Red Helmet. I got a call from somebody high up in the Romance Writers of America, and she said, Homer, I just read Red Helmet, and I don't know if you know it or not, but I do believe you wrote yourself a romance. And I took that as high praise. I mean, I think that genre is tough. Had I known that I was going to write a romance, I'm not sure I could have done it. I just kind of had to back into it. But it is. I mean, there's some really good fiction, really good literature coming out of the romance genre. It's super. So I'm going to wrap it up. And beginning, middle, and end. My end is that I am just absolutely honored to be here. This morning, by the way, 6 hours ago, I was down in a coal mine, 1,000 feet deep, 2 miles back into a mountain with Kathy Mattea, the country music star. And I wasn't exactly sure because, you know, rumor has it, a Hokie can't find Charlottesville, Virginia. But I did, and I'm happy to be here, and I'm especially just honored as I can possibly be to be here with Jill and Adriana. So thank you very much.
Homer, that was fantastic, and I think everybody who's familiar with his work knows that he's a great writer, and I think once he comes out of his shell, he's going to be a pretty good public speaker also. Thank you for being here tonight. I'm very happy to be in Charlottesville. I have a sister who moved here about 2 years ago with her husband and family, so I'm doing double duty. I have a chance to visit with them, so that's very nice. And you should all know that you have the reputation as being people not only who buy books, but who actually read them also. I thought I would talk a little bit about how I started my writing career and how I became a novelist. I've been writing professionally for over 20 years. And I started out writing columns for a very small newspaper on the North Shore of Boston. And in 1990, David Letterman's show on NBC was the hottest thing in comedy variety. And I was his biggest fan. And meanwhile, I was writing my little first-person columns. And I was spending the day doing things like going out on a garbage truck. Then I'd come back and write about it. I'd go out and see 4 or 5 palm readers. And then I would go back to the office, and I would compare their readings and write a little column. I would interview unique people. I interviewed a woman who had 2 pet llamas who she dressed up in Star Trek uniforms. That's exactly what my reaction was. And I used to watch the show and think that my columns would adapt very well to what David was doing at the time on the air. So with a mixture of naivete and audacity, I sent my columns to the show, and about 6 months later, they offered me a job. So I moved from Boston to New York, and became a writer for David Letterman, which was, at the time, my dream come true. And I spent the next 6 years writing top 10 lists, viewer mail responses, opening remarks, short video segments, and my remotes included Dave and a psychic competing to predict expiration dates on dairy products in a local deli. Dave and Zsa Zsa Gabor driving through a series of fast food restaurants in Los Angeles. And Dave and Carol Channing playing ping pong together, all the while her asking, "What's so funny about this again?" So after writing in a guy's voice for about 6 years, I would go home at night and I would start writing short stories. And up until that time, the longest thing I'd ever written were newspaper columns. And then I went, you know, the material I was writing at Letterman was very short because you have to write short for television. And at the time, I ended up selling four or five of my stories to HBO, and they were going to produce them as a series of monologues. And that really gave me the confidence to leave the show and try to write something longer. I'd always wanted to write a novel. And so I got sidetracked a little bit, and I ended up getting a development deal with ABC Television, and I wrote a couple of sitcom pilots. And one of those pilots was called Anna Says, and it was picked up by Steven Spielberg and Michael J. Fox, and it starred Tracy Pollan. And they spent $2 million producing and shooting this show, and it never did air, but I was hired as the creative, the creator, the head writer, and the executive producer. And from the time I started the script until I finished it, I had rewritten it more than 20 times. So this was 2000, and I was the year 2000, and I was 15 years into my career, and I had been nominated for 5 Emmy Awards. I was 33 years old, and at that point I was realizing if I didn't reallocate my time, I would never have a family. So I left television and I started writing a novel called Girls Poker Night. And 2 years later, when Girls Poker Night was on the New York Times bestseller list, I was described as Jill Davis, first-time writer. My novels focus on comedic realism. I need the subtlety and tension of drama that play out in real life for the comedy and the characters to work. Mainly my goal when I'm writing is to write comedy that is very empathetic, to create characters who seem like people you would know, and have them experience emotions and obstacles that feel real. In the case of my first novel, Girls Poker Night, a weekly poker game is used as a metaphor for the risks that my characters needed to take in order to grow. And a woman, Ruby Capote, is abandoned by her father when she's a child, and when she's an adult, she falls for a guy who had abandoned his own child. And that created the real-life drama of how this doomed love can be resolved. And even after I found the logical source of the drama, it took me months of not writing to figure out how to come up with a logical resolution. And so a good chunk of my writing life is spent writing, and then another part is spent just trying to solve problems off paper and then come back and write about them when I have the solutions. My second novel, Ask Again Later, came out in hardcover 2 years ago, and a year ago, and it just came out in paperback about 6 weeks ago. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Richard Russo called it serious and emotionally resonant, and it rewards at every level. In this book, I explore work as a replacement for love and the office culture as a replacement for family. Emily Rode is a young lawyer whose life is turned upside down when her mother is diagnosed with an illness. She moves back into her childhood home. Emily's father, who left when she was 5, reappears. And underneath, this is a story about divorce and how a child copes with an irrational loss of a parent. I'm going to read a few short chapters from the book now. The first chapter I'm going to read is, this is the day that Emily finds out that her mother was diagnosed with breast cancer. She finds a lump, and because I write comedy, this is a very curable disease. So, in this case, this chapter is called Instant Coffee, and Emily walks into her office about 2 hours late. She's a highly responsible person. She's never late for anything, and at this point in her life, she starts to become a little more irresponsible, understandably so. I walk into the conference room. Gray suits, white shirts, raised eyebrows, and unhappy looks in my direction. I take a seat. I mouth the word sorry to everyone who will look. Though some people don't look, they're too incensed that I have the gall to show up late when they've been in this cavernous chamber all morning. When I first became a lawyer, I loved the extreme detail of it, how language mattered, the way it required my full attention, and how, unlike my family, it was explicit in its meaning. I'd found the demanding job that needed me as much as I needed it. It was a dream come true. With time, you'd think too much of a good thing could only get better. But in my case, it's become suffocating. It's devoured all other parts of my life. I couldn't have said this yesterday. I couldn't have admitted it. Or maybe it was not yet true. I mouthed the word coffee to Jenny, the assistant. I know what you're thinking. Fetch your own coffee, lady. How sexist to expect young and spry Jenny to get the coffee. It's the other way around, of course. Jenny only gets coffee for men. In law school, I didn't imagine this would be one of my more difficult precedent-setting arguments. Jenny's paid to be a floater. That means seamlessly filling the gaps, floating from one task to the other without interrupting the flow of work and ideas. Jenny pretends she doesn't see me. Instead of aiming to be helpful and largely invisible, she pretends I am invisible. I wait until we make eye contact. Then I make a pouring motion. Still, I get the freeze. Jenny looks away from me quickly and begins removing imaginary lint from her skirt. I wait. I pounce again. I mouth the word coffee. This time, then I make a pouring motion followed by a sipping, oops, too hot, don't sip too fast motion. Jen, I start to say. Jenny, can you stop pretending you don't see Emily and get the goddamn coffee so she can quit it with the pantomime routine? Donald says. For the life of me, I'll never understand how the hell being paid to pour coffee landed on par with abuse. Donald is a man who does not wait for life and does not waste time on pleasantries. Donald is a doer. He gets shit done. Must be so satisfying to be Donald. I can already predict what form the ugly retaliation will take. Scalding hot instant decaf with non-dairy creamer. I miss my home. I wish it were yesterday instead of today. Too often, that is my wish. I'm going to read from another chapter called My Shrink. So when Emily's world starts to unravel, she starts to see a shrink, and she's frequently looking for anything to say but what would be relevant. So she's trying not to reveal anything. My Shrink. Paul's office is cozy. And by cozy, I mean there is a white wicker daybed in lieu of a couch. The first time I came to see him, there were pastel-colored butterfly sheets on the daybed. And I almost didn't come back because of that single detail. I tortured myself with what it could all mean, those butterfly sheets. Are we all meant to soar in this world, to see things from the vantage point of a metamorphosizing insect? Or were they just sheets that happened to fit the daybed? As soon as he gets an actual couch, I'll be lying on it. Until then, I'll sit in silence across from him in the black foam-stuffed pleather club chair. So, what's happening in your internal life? Paul asks. Who's got time for an internal life, I say. Not a hell of a lot happening in your conscious life, Paul says. Ouch, I say. Well, not anything you're willing to talk about, Paul says. I steal a glance at him. He needs a haircut. Like all shrinks, he wants me to talk about my mother. What happened to that guy, I ask, the one who had the appointment after me? Why do you ask, Paul says. I think I miss him, I say. I can't handle separations that aren't accompanied by lots of advance notice. I see, Paul says. You cured him, and I'm not sure I'll be able to forgive you for that, I say. Because you miss him, or because I cured him and not you? You're good, and feisty too, I say. But either way, you're in the wrong, and I'm not forgiving you. He laughs. His eyes go from happy to sad on a dime. He's mastered empathy. I used to like that ratty backpack he carried, even though he was way too old to carry a backpack, in my opinion. And then, just before he stopped seeing you, he switched to a leather briefcase. No scuffs, brand new. I should have taken that as a sign, I say. Sign of what, Paul asks. That he was ready to move on, that he'd grown up or something, I say. It's about being grown up, Paul asks. Ask again later, I say. It's my favorite non-answer. And then I shrug, I wait. I have no idea what it's about. But I return week after week in hopes of finding out. There is no such thing as grown up, Paul says. Well, that's encouraging, I say. If you really think about it, Paul says, it is encouraging. I stare at the trees in the park. There is ice on the branches. I can see the skeletons of old birds' nests. Every so often, the branches catch the wind like a kite, a visual lullaby. Some ice falls, and then I imagine the cost of pruning those trees. That always breaks the spell. Must be absolutely astronomical. The final chapter I'm going to read from is called Baby, and Emily's sister has a baby, and this Emily is just completely in awe of it, and she's at the hospital when the baby is born, and seeing her nephew for the first time has given her great optimism. Baby. Little Malcolm has the most perfect little round head and big blue eyes, the tiniest feet and fingers. They seem too tiny to function. His lips and skin are red, and his hair is jet black. He looks like a skinny, wet kitten. I can't help but stare in amazement at the only 7 pounds that could ever truly change Marjorie's world. They weigh him and measure him and roll his feet on an ink pad. What a clumsy introduction to the world. I get to hold him while Marjorie is being taken care of. He looks at me. He's studying me, staring at my enlarged pores. I turn my head. He keeps looking, the unrelenting observer. I whisper in his ear, confiding. I've tried facials. I've tried minimizers. Nothing works. He smiles. He knows stuff. He burps, and in that burp, I'm convinced, was a message. Try alpha hydroxy. Thank you. Knock him dead.
Great.
Oh, I can't follow these two. I have so many strings hanging off of me, forgive me. Homer, I'm such a fan. I adore you.
It's return.
Well, thank you, because I love you. And Jill, we have like we have children that are similar in age and stuff, and so we're old dear friends, and I love her. And I think the toughest thing to find, am I reverberating? Can you hear me?
A little bit.
Oh, now you like me. Now we can hear. Anyway, it's very hard to find beauty and funny in the same person, and you get that with Joe.
Thank you, Adri.
All right. Now, Homer says he didn't get any play in high school, and I believe him because he said it. But where's your wife, Linda? She is like so gorgeous, Homer. You did very well in adulthood. Where is she? You have to see her. I'm serious. She's really gorgeous. She won't stand up now. She's
probably
here somewhere. She probably went to the bar. Okay. Great. Well, for those of you who don't know, I'm from Big Stone Gap, Virginia, and I am completely in awe and blown away because Governor Linwood Houlton is in the front row here, and he wrote Opportunity Time. Will you please stand up, Governor Houlton? Now, he wrote the greatest book of the year, Opportunity Time, that I dropped everything I was doing and just read, couldn't put it down. I went crazy for it. There's so many wonderful things about Virginia history in there, but two of my favorite things is one, Governor Linwood Houlton's wife name is Jinx, and when she had a campaign bus, it was called Hi Jinx. And you're not getting that in this presidential campaign. You know, there's no... everybody's serious, everybody's mad. It's like, no hijinks. And of course, we should also say that the present governor of Virginia is your son-in-law, which that's pretty great. Crazy about him. All right. When I was on book tour, I'm just going to have to mention the water bottle, and then we'll get to Pound Virginia with my friend over there. Anyway, when I was on book tour in Florida, this is like 4 years ago, I followed Joan Collins from Dynasty. She did a fitness book. And I don't want to say nothing, but there's a person running around London right now with all the excess that she took off in surgery. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Little Joanie. Anyway, so I went to this bookstore, and it was very low-key. It was a lot of fun. It was pretty. It's that bookstore we love. What's that bookstore in,
We both went there. I can't remember it, but it's in Florida in a kind of a fancy town. Palm Beach Books. So there was a kid working in the store there, a nice young man, and he said, "Can I get you something to drink?" And I said, "I'm all right, you know, I got water with me." He said, "Joan Collins was just here and I got in big trouble." And I said, "Well, what happened?" And he said, "Well, she came into the bookstore, and she's known for this, and she was shoving and angry and just like, what do you want me to, I'm not talking to anyone, I'm going to sit down and sign my books, okay, fine." And she said, "And I'm dying of thirst, will somebody please get me something to drink?" And he brought her a bottle of water. And she looked at him and she said, "A proper lady drinks out of a glass," to the kid. He said, "That's why I brought you a bottle." Joan. Okay, the whole thing about Dant, Virginia, this, because we're Italian, and, you know, we looked for any small, weensy, teeny-weeny sign in Southwest Virginia that there might be some Italians up through there. And my mother, librarian that she is, said, "Look, Anthony," as we're driving through the little coal camps, "Dante must mean Dante's Inferno because of the coal ovens." And my father said, "It's called Dant, and get it straight." And so this started the whole, our whole sort of assimilation into Southwest Virginia, which I'm so proud to be from there. Pound, I think they moved your town. No, that was Coburn. They moved a town because it got flooded, but everything's fine now. Yeah, which town was it? Rye Cove. Grundy? Well, they moved Grundy, too. They've moved several towns. I don't want to let anybody down, but that's true. Anyway, so I have to tell you a funny story about my high school librarian, who I adored, Billie Jean Scott. Are there a lot of librarians here? Oh, worshiped my high school librarian. And recently, the Target stores, do you like Target? I love Target. They have this big read of the month, and they're doing A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. They're trying to pick like an American classic once in a while. And they said, "Will you write that letter that goes in the front of the book for the Target readers?" And I said, "Of course, because I love that book." And I remember that it was given to me by my high school librarian, Billie Jean Scott. Now, does anybody have a copy of Big Cherry Holler out there? No? Anybody? No? Okay, good. I'll have to do it from memory now, which is great. I'll wing it. Anyway, Billie Jean Scott was a very, she never married. She was very beautiful, little tiny brunette. She had the cat glasses, even in the 70s when they were over. She kept them. And now she's got, you know, regular ones. She still looks great. And she ran the library with really an iron hand. You really didn't talk in there or any of that sort of thing. And she was a very, very, and still is a very devout Methodist. And so when my book, Big Cherry Holler, came out, my mother called me and she says, "Adri, we have a problem." And I said, "Well, what happened?" And she said, "Well, Billie Jean Scott called me because I had written her a note, oh, you're in the book." And so my mother said to me, "Billie Jean said you wrote something about her in that book." And I said, "Well, I don't really remember exactly what I wrote." Okay. So I keep a list of names, like on the computer, of my teachers. And when they fit in a sentence, I just throw them in. I don't, like, think it's really them. I just get their names in there. So, I know. Billie Jean Scott said to my mother, "Ida, you need to get that book out and read it, because your daughter ruined 75 years of fine Christian living in one sentence." And I will paraphrase, but there's this big denouement. Now that you're writing romance, you get this one. You have Iva Lou, the bookmobile librarian, who's been with Billie Jean Scott's husband up on Skeens Ridge, and Billie Jean stops the car and blocks the bookmobile, and they have a showdown. And basically, okay, I can do it. I could do it, pray for me. Lent is over, but still pray. Okay. Basically, Iva Lou says to her, she says, Billie Jean says to Iva Lou, "Iva Lou, were you with my Hank?" And Iva Lou says, "Yes, ma'am, I was." And she says, "I'd like to thank you kindly. I've been trying to get rid of that son of a bitch for 35 years, and you gave me the excuse to give him the old leave-ho." That's the line. And I did, I remember. Thank Very you, good. That's without the book. So one other little funny thing. Okay, everybody in Southwest Virginia, for those of you who are from there, everybody's got nicknames. we identify people like by things that have happened to them. Like our plumber, his name is Doug Nichols, but we call him Doug, Do You Think I'm Sexy Nichols, because he always played Rod Stewart in his truck in the 80s. And so we named him that. And then we just started calling him, Do You Think I'm Sexy? And then we just call him, Do You? So he's Doug, Do You Nichols. Now, Doug had he went to prison for something for a little while. We don't ask, because he's our plumber, and we don't want to know, really. But he was in for like 3 years, so I think it was something bad. But it wasn't his fault, but he was in for 3 years. Okay. Now, recently, the last 2 weeks, I went home to Big Stone Gap because the town was hit by a tornado, which is terrible. Except the good news is no fatalities and no injuries, just a lot of panic, okay? And my mother lives there in the house that I grew up in. So, oh yeah, like her roof blew off, just a lot of stuff. So we all went home. There's 7 kids, and so it's nothing like a reunion. And, of course, right on the scene was Doug, Do You Think I'm Sexy Nichols? Now, when I was a girl, Doug said to me once, he said, your daddy is really smart. He should be an architect. Now, so we have, like, these Doug-isms. So, of course, the tornado brought, like, new Doug-isms into our vocabulary. He pulled my sister and me aside, and he says, because my other sister was talking to the insurance man with my mother. And this is what Doug said. Girls, now you listen to old Doug. You don't let that insurance company make you the scapegoat. The scapegoat. I said, Doug, we're going to try not to, but it's hard, you know. We were crying, we were laughing so hard. Anyway, Charlottesville, I have to just say this, and then I'm sure you want to ask questions, and we'll get to it. Oh, my friend from Pound, you're just glistening, you're gleaming. I love your diamond earrings. Anyway, mine are home shopping. Are yours real? Yeah. I know, I'm in Charlottesville, baby. I know they're real. This is the place we always came to compete for forensics. Is anybody here do forensics in high school? That's what the unpretty non-jocks do is forensics. And okay, one lady in the back, and you look good, so maybe it's not true. But anyway, we came and we did forensics. And I remember my high school English teacher, Frances Lewis, arguing with me because what I would do is read poetry and interpret poetry because it's, frankly, it was easy, and you got the free trip to Charlottesville, and you could go to Monticello, which I loved. I've been through Monticello. I could do the tour with you. I'm going to know everything in there. I was also happy that something else besides my name was pronounced correctly in the state of Virginia. Monticello and Trigiani. Okay, so, anyway, so we came, and I had chosen a poem that I thought was very cutting edge. It was Daddy by Sylvia Plath. You know that poem? I can still remember part of it. I'm doing good in my head tonight. This is very rare. But it started out and it says, Daddy, you do not do any more black shoe in which I've looked like a foot for 30 years. Do you remember this poem? It's about the Nazis. Well, I didn't know that. I just like the shoe image. So, so I'm revving up for competition. And there's some kids from my end of the state, and then there's kids from kind of all over the state, you know, where you get to meet everybody. It's really exciting. And my sister Pia, who's now an attorney, she, that's a lawyer. I had to say that because Doug might be here. And so she was always, I always said this about my sister Pia, like she cried all the time, and she grew up and became a lawyer, which I find so weird. Like, to me, if you cry all the time, you should be like the artist, right? And she's an attorney. Anyway, I mean, she's a good one. Anyway, so Pia is ahead of me. She's a year older than me, and she was doing the debate team, and I was doing the poetry read. And so I had my poem, Daddy, and I was all excited. And Pia came over to me because we saw the list of people and what they were reading, and she said to me, and my sister does not curse, but she said to me, you're screwed. And I said, why? I said, I feel like it's Charlottesville, it's UVA, it's intellectuals. Daddy is going to hit a home run today. I just feel it. She said, no, it's not. Well, there was a girl from Appalachia who was in competition. She didn't come on our bus, but she had written her own poem, which basically would sandbag everybody else in the competition. And I will never forget it because she won it right here on this campus. She got the first place. She had written a poem called Dusty Feet. It was about Jesus walking on Calvary. And she had long blonde hair, and she had it like, you know, he used to use those electric, you know, those electric, what's that thing called? The curling iron. All right, get, help me. Don't chastise me. Help me. Curling iron. And she put it in, and she looked beautiful, and she just, it was like she was having the beatific vision. She was seeing Jesus, and she just did this dusty feet. It was astonishing. And then I got up and read Daddy. Sucked. Anyway, at the end of it, they give you the critiques back. And, you know, you consider these judges like Olympic judges. Like, what are they going to say? And this is what the professor wrote. And see, I didn't forget this either. That's why I don't read reviews. So if there's anything bad out there, I don't know anything about it. Just live in a state of denial. And then I figure I'll get old and I'll die and no, I'll never have read them. Anyway, I won't have my feelings hurt. Anyway, it said, Adrena. Adrena read Daddy. She does not appear to have a grasp of the material. And then he wrote two words that I've never heard since. No cigar. That was horrible. I just tore my hair out. No cigar, no cigar. What does that mean, no cigar? No cigar. Oh, have I gone on too long? Should I wrap up? Look at Robert. He's just, you know, he's just handsome. He looks good. And whatever you want to do. Fine by me. I think I will close now, not with dusty feet. Aren't you lucky? But just to say that, you know, life is really, really... I think I'm staying in the same hotel I stayed with in high school with my guidance counselor. I think it's the same room. It's Miss Faith Cox, and I'll never forget. She's great. She's down in Big Stone Gap. Her roof just got a little bit damaged. But my seventh grade teacher, Arlene Sharp, who taught me to conjugate, her roof's gone, but she'll be all right. Anyway, so now that's what we remember everybody now, how the roof looks. Anyway, Faith Cox, we were in a room right at our hotel. I swear it's the same thing because it's enclosed in glass. You know that hotel? What's that called? The Cavalier Inn? Something. Best Western. Because I said to the lovely lady that picked me up at the airport, I said, how's the hotel? I'm a diva. So I didn't think anything of it. I got to the hotel and I got to my room and I went, it's just as if Faith Cox was in that room. And it was as if all over again I was rehearsing Daddy. Only to lose badly. Lovely. Anyway, thank you so much for having us. And Governor Holton, thank you for being here. And thank you all for coming. Don't want to sit. I really rambled, didn't I, girls? It was a rambling little talk. You can hear everything I'm saying, can't you? Isn't that wonderful? Okay. To Joan Collins, everyone. What a crab that woman is. Really. But she looks good.
Anybody want to get in this conversation?
We dare you!
Nancy, Adriana, do we need to change the
hotel
for you?
Nancy, oh, God, did I appear ungrateful? Nancy, no, honey, you don't need to change the hotel. Just get me some more towels. That'd be nice. Although, you know, it's better to have the smaller towels. When you get the big ones, I know I have a lot of hair, but when you get the big ones, it's like wearing a TV on your head. But the little towels, you can wrap, you know what I'm saying, you can wrap it tight, gets the hair dry quicker. So, no, I love my room. Don't you dare move me. I'm sure those foam pillows will be lovely tonight. I'll have to wear like Spanx on my head. I'll wake up looking like Mamie Eisenhower this time tomorrow. That's all right. It's all for art. All for art, yes.
I am way over my head. Yes, ma'am.
Oh my gosh! Just to really point, what's your name?
Sally.
Sally, and what are you with Virginia Press Women?
Yes.
Honey, you better write about my friends here. Anyway, look how I'm always playing it. No, I love that story. You want me to tell it real quick?
Oh yeah.
Oh, this was awful. Okay, now, in my family, okay, I'm not the pretty one or the smart one. I'm the funny one. I was always called the funny one. She's the funny one. Which, you know, down south doesn't mean a good thing. But if you're Italian, it means a good thing, but not in the south. It means, you know, like, you hide those people. Anyway, so, and I don't mind it. Look, you know, as you go on in life, you start to appreciate what you got. You just start, forget it. It doesn't matter anymore, does it? No, all right. Anyway, so, and I totally digressed to the point I forgot my story. Oh, about the man. Oh, so I go home for my first book signing. In Big Stone Gap, at the John Tolliver House. Governor Holton, you know where it rocks. It's the, well, John Fox Jr. wrote The Trail of Lonesome Pine, which is the highest selling novel in the United States prior to Gone with the Wind. Give him a plug, he's been dead for 100 years, what's the difference? Anyway, so, there's a house that's near the drama, it's the drama of his book, the outdoor drama. And so I've signed the books in this little house. And there's a line. As there would be, because it was something to do. And I don't want to play up like people were waiting to see me, but to either come see me or do nothing. So they came to see me. So I heard a man on the line say, I'm one of seven kids and we're like a year or two apart. This is what he said. I can't believe that's the one that made it. Awful. But see, the reason is I lost on Kitty College. Did you remember Kitty College? WCYB?
Yeah.
I was on with Ivy Lou Daugherty, Ivy Lou from my book, and Kathy Greer, she's a Baptist preacher's daughter, and I was the captain. I became mesmerized with myself on the monitor and lost my intellect. I hadn't been on TV. I was just looking at myself, and at halftime, they cut the camera to the audience, and all my brothers and sisters, my mother had them in their Sunday clothes, and this is what my sister did when the camera came. And now, his name was Art Countess. He was the host, and he said, and now we're going to show all the friends and family that came to the studio to watch the Kitty College contestants. And they moved the camera, and my sisters go like this when the camera hits, and they go. We didn't have our game on. We were nervous. And the three of us, and we were fighting with each other and everything. And there's these three little boys from Kingsport, something, Central, something, little bow ties, and they beat us so bad. And then at the end, they call you. I just have to tell this, and then I'll stop. They call you up, and I'm the team captain, so I have to accept the prize. So I had dreamed that we won. And that we were gonna do a lot with this money, and then you go back and you win more money. And I'd already had it spent, like, years in advance. Like, we'll come back every week for 100 weeks, and we'll be rich, you know? Well, we lost, so we got a case of Pepsi for our next school party and a check for $5. Now, my family's still in the audience, and I guess my face fell. I was just crestfallen. When I heard $5, that was like, I was counting on 20, and it was like $5. And so Art Countess made the mistake. He said to me, what are you going to do with that $5, Adriana? And I said, well, we were going to buy all the Nancy Drews, but now I guess we're only going to buy one.
questions, comments for Homer or Jill?
Yes, please.
Funny stories about going through book signing lines.
Yeah. Oh, have you got any of those?
Yeah. Surely you must.
Well, I was just, I'll tell one just very quickly. I was just in a line that was 4 hours long in Huntington, West Virginia. They like me up there, you know. And I like to give everybody a moment. I mean, I'm not one of those who just puts my head down and just signs. Everybody comes up to me. They always have a story they want to tell, and I let them tell it. And I, you know, I make sure that I've got their name exactly right, and I describe it exactly the way they want it. So for 4 hours, I had done that, and I had another one in Charleston. I know it was going to be about as long. And a guy came up to me. He had been waiting on the fringe. I'd been watching him out of the corner of my eye, and he came up to me, and he said, "I just got one question for you. Do you still work?" And I said, "Buddy, this is work."
Gate City. See, these are my peeps. I'm related. Yes, my darling.
And I've heard rumors through the years that the book Big Stone Gap was going to be made into a movie.
Mm-hmm.
What is the status of it?
Yes, it's happening this summer. And I would tell you who was starring in it, except I have to tell the Richmond Times-Dispatch first because I promised them. But it'll be, you're going to hear next couple weeks. I'm so excited. I can't even with the tornado. I kind of played that down to my producers. It's just a couple trees up. Oh, every tree in town. But we'd get more trees in there. Good. But thank you, and please come. Are you gonna, are you in Gate City now?
No.
All right. Well, you come see me. Well, now you've got an excuse to go home. Come and see us there on Main Street.
This is Southwest Virginia evening. Somebody in the lobby just before we started said she was from Scott County. So.
Wow.
Yeah.
I'm digging that.
Okay. Okay, the question was about translating or transferring your own life into a fictional work, which presumes that one does that. But the other is about the humor, incorporating humor into what you do. Is that the second part?
Yeah, just sort of balancing so that it's not all funny. I mean, you're taking
okay, balancing humor.
And talked about how breast cancer is not always funny, which means
me. Okay.
Right.
Jill?
Well, I think one of the questions I think you're asking is how autobiographical is your work? In my case, psychologically, it's very autobiographical, but there aren't specific things I pull from my life, for the most part, that are direct. And then anytime, I think for a joke to play, it has to, in my case, be in a realistic situation. If it's just joke, 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 it's more of a monologue. And so to create a condition for the jokes to be funny, I'm generally coming up with something like that. But there was one thing that happened to me when I was a reporter early on. I think it was the second week on the job. I was 20 years old. I was in journalism school, and I worked for a newspaper. And I was interviewing an older woman for a cooking column. So my assignment was go out, interview a woman in the community, write down her 6 best recipes, you know, write a little feature. And so at some point at the end of the interview, I'm just going over the recipes, and I look up and I say, "I think we're finished," and she's dead. So I wrote about that in my first book, but that's one of those things. I didn't have to change much for the book, to put it in the book.
Wow.
I guess I'll go next.
That's a hard story to follow.
That is a hard story to follow. I may cry. I don't know. But one thing I learned early on in my life is that what people are really interested in is other people. When I was in the third grade, my teacher told me, "Someday, Sonny, you're going to be a writer." And I thought to myself, "Why, wait, I could use the money now." So I formed a little newspaper, and make a long story short, it wasn't very popular until one day my ace reporter and I, a boy named Roy Lee Cook, later became one of the Rocket Boys, we followed the preacher's wife around the company store, and we wrote down everything that she put in a basket, everything. And we published it. And we were a huge hit after that. And we became sort of the Colwood, you know, Inquirer. And I ultimately wrote a story about this lady falling down in the creek and while she was chasing a snake, and it was my best story. Only problem was that woman was my mom. And my First Amendment rights got taken away for about 30 years. But anyway, the point being is what made us popular was it was I learned at that moment that people are really interested in other people. And so anytime that I write, whether it's fiction or nonfiction, what I really hone in on is that character, that person. That's what really matters. Is I want to get you totally involved with who that person is, and you want to follow them. You want to find out what's going to happen to them. That to me is the real thrill of writing both nonfiction and fiction. You know, I mentioned earlier about my memoirs. I call them novoirs. They're written like novels. They belong over in fiction, even though they're true. I wrote them as if it, you know, let's face it, To Kill a Mockingbird is just Harper Lee's memoir tricked up a little bit. And so, a little bit. So, you know, people make mistakes, say Rocket Boys is about rockets. It's not at all, it's about people. And, you know, people with To Kill a Mockingbird say it's about loggers, and we know better than that, too. But no, that's my point, though. It's just that I think that we all bring in our experience. We all bring in the people that we know and feel, and we create these characters in our heads, and they become very, very real to us. But, you know, everything is based upon the experience. That's your filter. That's how you create these characters and move them along. I love writing about Josh Thurlow back in World War II. That to me is, you know, that's historical fiction. I love that genre, historical fiction. And I love creating these characters, Cable and Song, in Red Helmet, that they have this romance. So. You know.
Anyone else? Nancy?
Sure.
Who wants to have a first shot at this?
Sure. Because I'm fascinated with combining empathy with humor, I've always loved writers like John Kennedy Toole. I think in Confederacy of Dunces, he does just an incredible job of combining all of those elements. And I think similarly, Wally Lamb does it, and She's Come Undone. So I'm always drawn to a story that seems so intimate, so real, and at the same time, heartbreaking and funny. Those are things I've always, always loved. I love Tim O'Brien, Tobias Wolff. I tend to really enjoy first-person fiction, and that's what I write, and that's what I'm drawn to.
I recall you saying at some point that you liked Hess, Hermann Hesse.
I was in high school and junior high school. I was obsessed with him. Anything I could get my hands on, I would read. I just loved him.
It's somewhat different.
Yes, absolutely. I think I was. I think it was a intense brooding phase of a teenager. So.
I really was, and still read Jane Eyre every year. I love Jane Eyre. I'm so compelled to her because here she's this. She's no connections, no family. You know that one mean aunt that's rude. And she's put in an orphanage, and she has no reason. Really to make anything of herself, but in her is a drive to make something of herself, and then she falls in love with a guy that, you know, when my daughter's 13, I'm going to hand her that book and just go, this is Men in a Nutshell. Rochester. Falls off a horse, broods. Goes through town, broods. Has a wife in the attic, doesn't tell you, broods. I mean, these are brooding. I would say Jane Eyre. I was very, because I'm going through this, my daughter's five, where you're looking at books again, that you're looking ahead, what you're going to read, or trying to read her chapters now and stuff, and Pippi Longstocking, and you think about Madeline L'Engle. Those books from when I was a kid is still really, really move me. And then of recently, I'm not kidding, like I loved Opportunity Time. I love a memoir. I love Homer's work for that reason. I love yours because I feel they're in the first person, and I love first person also.
Right now I'm reading the letters of Noel Coward, and I just, it's thick, it's phenomenal. If you love the theater, you love writing, or it's just, and it's hilarious, and all these relationships, I'm very invested in them. Is that a good answer? Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
John Steinbeck, even though he won a Nobel Prize, I think he's an underrated writer. I love all his stuff. Cannery Row is my favorite. If you haven't read that, go back and read it. It's only 100 pages long. It's magnificent. It's sort of a memoir, in a way. I can't read too much Steinbeck while I write, because I end up writing bad Steinbeck. It takes me about 2 weeks to get out of his voice and back into it. The modern-day writers I mentioned that I love, historical fiction, I think Patrick O'Brien, if you haven't read any of his stuff, I strongly recommend it. It's they made a bad movie called Master and Commander from his first novel. It's about, I so admire his prose. He's able to write about nothing for pages, and I'd love it. I want to find out what's going to happen. And it's about nothing. They're out on the ocean. It's just a long voyage, and it's just incredible. The other writer that I think is very underrated is Nelson DeMille. Nelson and I happen to be fellow Vietnam veterans, so we get to welcome home each other every time we see each other. But I think that although Nelson is kind of stuck in this thriller genre, that Gold Coast is probably one of the best books that's been written in the last 25 years, other than what Jill and Adriana have written, of course.
Well, thank you all very much for joining us here. If you would keep your seats.